Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by David Lawanda, who is Director of Mobile Engineering at Major League Baseball. It's great to have you join us today. I'm sure you're very busy, so thanks for taking the time to sit down with me.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
It's cool. Pleasure. To get us started, could you give us a bit of background on yourself and a bit about your route into the world of technology?
Sure. Yeah. So I, grew up as a child of the 80s. My father was an accountant and a controller of a construction company, and they had computers on in the office. And I would go with him actually about this time of year during tax season on the weekends when he was working overtime to prepare the taxes. And, would help him out. He would pay me out of the petty cash drawer to, initially it was just, copying and shredding old documents, but it later became doing things like bank reconciliation on these old computer systems, even predating the Microsoft DOS and Windows days. I received a computer at home when I was 13 and really took to it, really just was an eye-opening experience. A year later, got a modem and got online on American Online, when they were mailing floppy disks all over the world, all over the country, at least. Mm. It fed my love. The idea that I could control this machine through, code was a thing that was pretty revolutionary. I ended up taking a couple of years of computer science in high school, which was relatively unique at that point in the late 90s. Ended up going to the university at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, majoring in computer engineering, which was sort of split between hardware and software engineering. Wasn't sure which way I wanted to go. Picking one of those two directions. Eventually, after many courses, decided software engineering was the route for me. Ended up getting a master's degree and left school in 2003. Obviously, this was before, the iPhone and mobile had taken root. And started out more as an embedded systems engineer, building my first job out of school as a Department of Defense contractor, building communications software for the Department of Defense, the U.S. military. Did that for a couple of years. It wasn't exactly Mission Impossible, or as sexy as it might have been imagined. So at that point, I pivoted away from that. Took an opportunity to work in a television broadcast equipment company, making servers and equipment that went to companies such as CNN, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and those type of things. Mm. We had a bunch of equipment I remember the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver was one spot. But when that area and that domain sort of dried up after the switch from digital from analog. And that's around the time mobile was also becoming a thing. I really thought I had an opportunity to go work for a startup in Philadelphia. I'd lived in the Philadelphia area after school and working on some consumer networking software that we initially built for desktop, but kept sniffing around mobile. I guess I remember it was right in 2009, I bought my first MacBook Pro and an iPod Touch, thinking I'd do some exploration on my own into mobile development. And then my son was born and that all went out the window to some degree. But later I was able to pursue a job in New York City with Samsung. And that was my first opportunity to really dip my toes actually on the Android side. But I've always been an Apple aficionado and pivoted from there into iOS development at Birchbox. And then later, joining MLB back in 2017. And so it's been just about 4 years now. The last 2.5 to almost 3 years, I guess in May it'll be 3 years, as the director of mobile engineering, responsible for the app formerly known as AtBat, that's been in the App Store since the day the App Store launched. We rebranded as the MLB app early in 2020 for better fan recognition, but it is our keystone product for the touch point with MLB fans across the country and even internationally. I know we sent MLB to London back in 2019, and we were supposed to do it again last year in 2020 before the pandemic got in the way. I've been a baseball fan even longer than I've been a technology fan.
Wow.
Going back to my early childhood and with my dad. So, being able to combine those two together has been a really great opportunity.
That's really interesting. I mean, you've obviously had a love for the industry for a long time, or technology for a long time since you were very young. And I've got a couple of things that I want to ask. And one of them is, what still excites you about it?
I think a lot of it is just how amazing it is, what we've accomplished. I have two kids at home, almost 10 and almost 12-year-old. And the fact that any question they have, I can answer for them. We have a Google Home that we can, hey, Google, and it'll, chirp back at us, whatever we're looking for. The fact that I can, I've got some smart home stuff set up that, really makes the house feel alive and intelligent, You know, the fact that we're carrying these supercomputers in our pockets or even on our wrists that are more powerful than the computers that sent a man to the moon 50 years ago is mind-blowing. You know, and just being able to continue to take advantage of that, you know, explore, you know, things that, you know, you think back, you know, even in my childhood, you know, what it would be like without that is so hard to imagine.
Mm-hmm. It is genuinely unbelievable, isn't it? And I find that technology is speeding up. It's just, it's all the time, there's new technology. And not just small developments. There's some technologies that are coming out which are huge. You know, it's amazing to be a part of. And, you know, I was also wondering, as you've been in working in technology for pretty much your whole life, really, and I've realized that you have to constantly be learning about tech to stay working in it. So I was interested to find out what resources you rely on to continue to learn.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a challenge. And part of it is knowing, you know, obviously what the next thing is going to be. Mm. But also part of it is, you know, trying to drink from the fire hose, you know, of the internet. And you can find, you know, like I said, you can find anything you want to know. You have to be better at vetting what's real and what's fake. Yeah, for a long time, I mean, it was buying the O'Reilly books, you know, with all the animals on the covers and keeping those on a shelf. Then it was, you know, been a lot of Stack Overflow. But at MLB, we're lucky that we have access to, you know, O'Reilly, Safari Online, and Udemy. I've used LinkedIn Learning. I've looked at Coursera. I haven't used that one specifically. I know my kids have used Khan Academy for their schooling. And I read a lot of stuff on Medium, you know, try to find people I respect in the field and follow along. I think podcasts have come a long way and are contributing a lot to that as a way to keep up. You know, we've purchased a spin bike, not the brand name you probably would expect, but similar one. And I listen to a lot of podcasts. You know, I don't necessarily do the traditional spin classes as much, but want to just, you know, put it on a ride and listen to something like what we're recording right now and learn a lot about, you know, technology, software development, sports, you know, other interests that, you know, and it's a really good way to engage. When I used to ride the train back and forth to New York prior to COVID hitting, you know, again, podcasts were another good way, as well as those online resources I mentioned.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it, with podcasts? Because I find, you know, they're a relatively new thing, really. They've not been around for that long. But I find you can absorb so much more information so much easier when you're just listening to a podcast. I don't know what it is. I mean, for me, podcasts are naturally and definitely the way that I would learn. And I don't know, it just seems like a much more natural way to learn about things, really. And I think, you know, hearing people talk about things is an important aspect. And then also learning off other people is a big aspect of learning as well. Would you say that you learn off your peers?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, certainly as far as that. I mean, yeah, I've had a number of opportunities to work with some really smart people at multiple different jobs where, you know, I mean, I worked at one job where our chief architect could cite both the C++ spec chapter and verse and the MPEG spec chapter and verse. I mean, you know, he had the, you know, the bit manipulations in his head, and, you know, he wrote his own parser for this language we built as our interoperability, something similar to like Google Protocol Buffers, you know, an early version of that, which really, you know, simplified our development, you know, and provided the contract for our API between our front end and back end. Yeah, I mean, again, multiple places. I worked with a hardware engineer at my first job when we were doing that, who, you know, was just extremely proficient at being able to lay out an FPGA, and, you know, really understood that. And I really enjoyed getting, you know, an opportunity to work with him. I've never wanted to be the smartest person in the room. I actually would rather not be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really have enjoyed that, you know, being in a room of some really smart people and working hard to try and keep up.
Yeah. I've heard that before. Never be the smartest person in the room. I find that really interesting. It's definitely true though. You know, I'm thinking as a director of mobile engineering, and obviously nowadays, you know, we've got a lot more teams working remotely, even across the world. You know, they don't even have to be in the same city or the same country. So I'm just curious, as a manager and a leader, how do you lead distributed teams? Is that a new challenge that you've had to face?
Yeah, no, it's something I've been dealing with for probably about 5 years now, since 2016, actively as a manager. I've worked on some distributed teams prior to that even, but as a manager specifically, back in 2016, I did a stint for about 7 or 8 months with a startup that I came into that had already formed. They were actually not a great shape when I joined, and that's a lot of the reason why they didn't make it. But they had originally outsourced their tech. The two co-founders were in New York City, but they had outsourced the tech through a business connection the CEO had to a company in, or a development shop in Finland. They had one developer in New York, another developer they contracted through in London. After I joined, we ended up contracting out additional work to a group in outside of Montreal, yeah, and another group in Colombia. So we were, you know, extremely distributed. And yeah, there's definitely some challenges there. I think the biggest challenge when you're distributed, more so than geography, is time zone.
Yeah.
When I joined MLB, we actually had a number of contractors on staff as well. We had folks in Barcelona and one in Mexico City, as well as folks in San Francisco. So the, you know, we were stretching time zones from, you know, from Central European time out to Pacific time US, where there really was only 1 hour or 1.5 hour for stand up at noon Eastern. It was really the only overlap between Barcelona and San Francisco, as you can imagine. And that's where I think the challenges come when, you know, obviously the tools we have like Zoom, like Slack, or, you know, those, you know, when you're working in an office these days, when these open floor plans, you end up on headphones and the communication from a remote location isn't that much different than when you're sitting next to each other, when you're Slacking each other or Zooming with each other, as we've had to do. But when you're having to deal with time zones and trying to get people aligned where, you know, the folks in, whether it's Barcelona or Finland, are starting their day super early, you know, compared to East Coast, especially West Coast time. And, you know, they, you need to make sure that, if you know, you have folks reporting to you, they have assignments, they know what they can, you know, they can be able to get started while it's still way too early to be online with them. I think back to, there was one in that opportunity when I was working with the folks in Finland. I actually was going to a conference in San Francisco. I flew out late on a whatever night it was. I guess it was probably a Sunday. And to arrive, you know, so I could go to the conference Monday morning in San Francisco. But by the time I got into my hotel, it was just about like 8 or 9 a.m. in Finland. And the engineers were starting to wake up. And I got ended up, you know, they needed something. And I got involved in a conversation and ended up not getting to bed till like 2 or 3 in the morning Eastern time, which is what I was still on, because, but I, you know, you had to make sure that they had what they needed to be able to stay productive. So making sure that those lines of communication, it often takes a lot of over-communication. At least that's the way I bias towards, which can be hard. A lot of engineers are introverts by nature. I'm certainly introverted naturally, so they're not necessarily the most forthcoming or don't want to be disturbed by a manager. But I think that's part of what we need, because there is also some level of FOMO, you know, fear of just being out of the loop. I think being fully distributed is an easier solution than semi-distributed, where you have folks in the office. That's where more of that FOMO comes out. If you've got, you know, a core group that's in an office and, you know, walk into the conference room and walk out of the conference room together, you know, have those side conversations, or might go grab lunch after a meeting. And then you've got one or two folks who are distributed. You really have to pay attention to make sure those distributed folks don't feel subjugated or, you know, not as important to the team.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there is difficulties with having distributed teams, like, obviously, but do you think that the pros outweigh the cons?
I think there's definitely, there are a lot of pros, and I definitely think it allows for some really good opportunities. I think it's, I don't want to say there's a absolute answer necessarily. I think it's, you got to weigh your pros and cons. If you need some very specialized skills, being able to distribute so you can draw from the larger talent pool, that's, you know, where you need somebody who's specific. Like, I know at MLB we have, you know, some connected device platforms that, you know, we support, like Roku, where there's a very specific skill set that, you know, it's not like just knowing Swift or Objective-C or Java, like, or Kotlin for Android, where there's a much bigger talent pool to draw from. You know, you need to be able to find those people. And if you can give the folks an option not to relocate to where we have an office, whether it's New York or our offices in Boulder or our offices in San Francisco, you get an opportunity to, you know, really draw upon a bigger talent pool. Also, having worked in the startup world, I think it gives you an opportunity to potentially save money. You don't have to pay New York or San Francisco or London salaries. You know, if people get that opportunity to work in a secondary market that, you know, where the cost of living just isn't as high. And I think that's the trend that's really, you know, even some of the bigger companies appear to be exploring, you know, what the pandemic has accelerated.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really interesting. And I completely agree. And also, I was thinking it probably depends a lot on, you know, you were saying it depends on who you're trying to hire and what skill set they need. And also, it massively depends on the industry, really, what industries people are working in. I mean, I can imagine sales, and if you're in a sales environment, it would massively help to be in a sales environment surrounded by, you know, your peers and people doing a similar thing. So, yeah, yep. It does depend. And I think engineering as well, and, you know, tech, it massively lends itself to working remotely. And it's amazing with the pandemic how quickly these tech companies have adapted, really. It was almost overnight, really. It was just such a smooth transition.
Well, I mean, I can say certainly MLB is an interesting spot because we are the technology arm of MLB is very much more focused and aligned with the best practices of the large tech companies. You know, we have folks who've come in from, you know, who work at MLB, who've been at Google or Amazon or Apple or Facebook at various times. So we're much more aligned with that. But the larger MLB organization is not. It's a lot of folks who are, you know, there's big legal, sales, marketing, operations, events, who are much less familiar with the idea of working remotely. And even before the pandemic, the team I have, we were working remotely 2 days a week, Mondays and Fridays from home, and you know, Tuesday, Wednesdays, Thursdays in the office. That was a better setup for our team. And that even caused some consternation in the larger organization. Why would you, shouldn't everybody be on site? Shouldn't everybody be more closely aligned? You know, that's not something that was familiar to that other, those other operations or other teams within the organization. But I think for techs especially, I mean, I can even go back from 2007 to 2010, I was working for a company that we ended up going remote because due to acquisition, we were a small office and they moved us and consolidated us with a larger office that was going to end up, you know, on a map as the crow flies was not a huge, it was only about 50 miles, which was reasonable, I guess, to consider as a commute, but it required going through Philadelphia, which the traffic, if anybody knows Philadelphia, they know the traffic is insane. It was anywhere from an hour and 10 to 2 hour commute each way for me. And some folks even in the team were even further. So we went semi-remote where 4 days a week we worked remotely and 1 day a week we got into the office, you know, to have our meetings and have some of that face time. And I think that worked really well. Actually, that's what I'd like to explore coming as sort of that hybrid model coming out of the pandemic, you know, where people feel comfortable. They have their home office setups that they like to work in, you know, the quiet solitude, since you don't get an office most, you know, until you get to the highest of levels these days and can do your best work. And then, you know, once a week, if it's, you know, if you're located like we are in the Metro New York area, or even if it's a more distributed team, once a quarter, once every 6 months, have a junket where everybody gets together and can, you know, have that FaceTime, get to know each other a little bit better, you know, maybe go out and grab a beer if COVID isn't happening and, you know, can get that, but then can, you know, redisperse and continue to function.
Yeah. And I've just been thinking about the benefit it has, remote working has, sorry, with startups, because, you know, if you think about startups like 10, 15 years ago, they'd have to hire a premise and, you know, they're trying to save every penny, you know, they can't waste a penny. So having like a cool office in the center of, you know, Manchester or wherever would cost a lot of money. So for startups, it must be like revolutionary, really.
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, I think we're heading in that way with, you know, things like WeWork and the shared office spaces where you could, you know, you could perhaps get it more cheaply, you know, kind of similar to the, you know, the cloud server model instead of, you know, the more expensive option that was more traditional was to get your own office and decorate it yourself and have it in a spot, but then you're beholden to it. Then moving to WeWork is more like moving into an AWS or GCP type model where, you know, you don't have to worry about the decorations. You just, you know, you pay for what you need, you know, the pay-to-go model. But I think we've further moved even beyond that to more like a serverless function is the analogy there of really just, you know, maybe you rent a conference room again once a week as a startup to get your folks together, or once a quarter, or once a year. And then, you know, otherwise, you know, you disperse and work from your home, and the cost you save on utilities and coffee is monumental and game changing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious to find out what some of the challenges that you found are when hiring mobile engineers to work on streaming platforms. You know, it doesn't seem like it's a very common skill or kind of common thing that people would learn. Are they difficult to find?
It's definitely, having some experience there is good. I don't think it's a skill that's that overcomable, especially on the Apple platform specifically where I've been working. Apple has done a really great work making those APIs pretty familiar and pretty easy to spin up on, assuming you follow the model. I mean, Apple designed and implemented the HLS spec, the HTTP live streaming spec that pretty much everyone's using these days for streaming. So as long as you're playing in that sandbox, it's not that far that any good iOS engineer can't read the docs and spin up on. But, you know, to get it working, you know, the basic functionality, obviously the subtleties are in the, you know, the devil's in the details of that. So definitely good to have some experience. At least in New York, we've had a decent opportunity recruiting people who've had experience one way or another. You know, there are candidates to be had given how big streaming is. You get a lot of the, you know, whether it's a sports organization like MLB or the, you know, television networks, like, you know, the big broadcasters, you know, they've all invested in it. So I don't think it's terribly that hard. And again, a strong engineer should be able to pick it up. I think, you know, what Apple at least does is they give you really two options at the opposite ends of the spectrum. You either build, take what they have and where they're, you know, very opinionated and very specific, you know, and make it really easy for you, basically package it all up. And, but it looks like the way you want, they want it to look, or they give you all the pieces, you know, laid out on the bench for you. And you got to figure out how to put it together. You know, if you want custom UI around, you know, what the button should look like, or, you know, what functionality you want it to do, whether when it comes to, you know, some of the more auxiliary pieces like AirPlay or Chromecasting, you know, which you have to integrate with Google, that's where, you know, the complexities are. And, you know, if you're just dealing with, you know, clips of content, you know, pre-recorded stuff versus, you know, live is definitely obviously harder. And, you know, those are the challenges, but a lot of it depends on the platform that's providing the media. At MLB, we're using the platform that had been built by MLB Advanced Media, but as was later part of the spinoff into what was called BAMTech and the acquisition by Disney, and is the same engine that powers, or the same platform that powers Disney Plus and ESPN Plus that, you know, the folks who had worked for MLB originally built and sold as part of that about almost 4 years ago now.
Interesting.
You know, there's the other options there, you know, the big players, whether it's something like YouTube, you know, or, you know, I'm sure there are other of the big players in the game have their own Facebook Watch, Amazon Prime, you know, these platforms are out there.
Some of the people that I've spoken to on the podcast, they say that a lot of their work wouldn't have been possible or would have been very, very difficult without the cloud. I'm just curious to find out if you still rely on the cloud.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We went through a major migration. The original build out in MLB was with AWS, but anybody who's been following the news in our space or, you know, watches our content knows we've done a big deal with Google. Now we're using GCP. You know, I think we're still actually using both to some degree, although we've got a big deal with Google. And I think really it comes down to scalability, the ability to scale up and scale down.
Yeah.
Otherwise, similar to what we were just talking about with the, you know, the office space that analogy I made, the fact that you can, you know, scale up on demand without having to build out to the maximum cost. I mean, baseball is a very seasonal product. I'm not sure how familiar you are, but we start our season in April or late March, most years. This year it's April 1st. And it goes through the end of the World Series, you know, the championship ends just about the end of October. And it, you know, it ebbs and flows through those 6 or so months, you know, peaking, you know, actually the most traffic is not during the championship series, but during the middle of the season when all 30 teams are playing, you know, we'll have 15 games a night, you know, depending on which markets are doing well, you know, if the bigger markets like New York or LA or Chicago, their teams are doing better, we'll see more traffic. Than if, you know, they're having an off year and the smaller markets are in front. So being able, you know, just being able to scale on demand is really the benefit the cloud provides there. From my perspective, from where I've sat, obviously I'm not as directly involved with the back end piece there, but just knowing that, you know, we can scale up and support it when we need to is the big win.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now I want to ask you talk a little bit about your career reflection, if we could look at that, and then, you know, maybe a bit of advice. So, you know, you've had a lot of different jobs in your career, and I'm just interested to find out how have you personally handled unexpected job changes, if you have.
Sure. Yeah, no, I definitely have a couple times, unfortunately. I mean, I think the biggest thing you have to do is you have to be proactive. You have to keep, you know, ear to the ground, listen to those rumblings. I've caught a couple before. You know, they were unexpected. I made the move before the bottom dropped out. But a couple of times I have been caught unaware of changes that were not my choice to leave. And I think beyond being proactive, it's also being your own best champion, you know, making connections, not being reticent to, you know, connect when people reach out to connect with you, at least, you know, networking, being willing to, you know, whether it's going to a meetup like we used to, I guess, again, before COVID, or even a virtual meetup nowadays, reaching out, making connections, you know, being willing to be mentored and mentor with folks, you know, not just in technology too, you know, partnering with folks, whether it's business folks, product, sales, you know, putting a good name out there so that when people think, oh, I need a technologist. Oh yeah, I remember that guy, Dave. I worked with him, you know, and, or when you need something, you can reach out and, you know, if somebody you worked with before is doing something interesting, you can ping them and they'll remember you fondly. And, you know, if not, you know, take you with them, point you in a direction where they might be able to help. Because I generally think most people are very much willing to help, you know, they get it, you know, they understand, you know, you're looking at something. If they have a connection, they'll, you know, be willing to make the introduction. At least that's been my experience. And, you know, so I think we can, you know, again, making sure that you don't get caught unaware when possible, you know, which again, I think is part of it, but and then making sure you have that network thing to fall back on when it does happen is the biggest learn for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that advice is kind of transferable across most industries, actually. I can't really think of an industry that it wouldn't be useful for. I think growing your network is a big one.
Right. I'd say the only other thing is, again, is also, I think you touched on it before, that, you know, just staying up on technology, you know, the challenges around, you know, making sure you don't get, you know, pigeonholed in. I mean, I guess even folks who pigeonholed, you know, COBOL programmers became really important around the Y2K, you know, after not being useful for 10, 15 years prior. Yeah. So maybe you get lucky, but I wouldn't want to count on something like that happening again. You know, I started out again in the embedded system world where a lot of C++ and then Java. I sort of missed the web development, you know, certainly the web 2.0, and I wouldn't consider myself strong in that area necessarily. But when I saw that, you know, Google came out with Go and Apple came out with Swift around the same time in 2014, I knew that I needed to, you know, bone up on that. I haven't as much time to invest in Kotlin, but I know that it looks enough like Swift that I feel like it's something I could pick up. So I feel like you just got to stay on top of these things and whatever, you know, you can't know everything. You certainly can't. It's too broad to try and do everything from, you know, Rust to Go to Swift to Kotlin to, you know, JavaScript, TypeScript, you know, and all the things that, you know, go along with it. But you got to pick a few things, become really knowledgeable, you know, broad. I think somebody explained to me, you know, the shape of the letter T. You got to have enough breadth, but you also have enough depth in one specific area to, you know, be able to own that and be ready to change, be ready to accept that. You know, you might have to look for something if you do find that change that might not be exactly what you had been doing before, and be ready to move in that direction.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's new technologies and frameworks and things coming out all the time. So how do you know what's worth investing time into? How do you know what's like just, you know, a flash in the pan new technology that says it's the best thing, but then actually flops? And how do you know if it's like the next big thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. From my experience, and specifically having worked most familiarly in the Apple ecosystem, a lot of that is set by Apple. You know, it's pretty clear when they start signaling things, like the team at work, we've been having a lot of conversations and doing some work early in Swift UI, the new declarative UI framework that Apple released initially in 2019 and iterated last year to a second version in 2020. That's definitely been one of these things that we're trying to suss out. But similar to what we did when the move from Objective-C to Swift a few years earlier, you know, is it a real thing? I think a lot of it comes from, if Apple says so, it is.
Right.
And you just have to be ready for it. But then again, I think there's a lot of things that are, even within the Apple ecosystem, you know, we did some early explorations, some demoware, never productized, some work around ARKit back in 2017 that showed some potential, but we weren't sure it was really right for our business. You know, the use case we had was, you know, and then, you know, I'd have to find the old articles that we got some press on it, at least the idea that you could hold up your phone or your iPad, if you brought an iPad to a baseball game, which you probably shouldn't. And you could basically, using ARKit, provide the data overlays like you would if you were watching the game on TV. Like,
really?
What is this batter's batting average? Or, you know, how many strikes has this pitcher thrown, or that? And when it worked well, it was pretty cool. It was, you know, pretty revolutionary. But the same time we were working on that, there was a incident at the New York Yankees baseball game where a little 2-year-old girl was hit by a foul ball that, you know, because she wasn't paying attention.
Oh, wow.
And we kind of had to table the conversation a little bit, because you really shouldn't, you know, if you're at the game, you're there to watch the game. You should be enjoying the game. You shouldn't be holding your phone up in front of you for, you know, minutes on end, you know, not just for safety reasons, but, you know, just general health and well-being. You know, maybe it's time to put the device away. So I think, you know, figuring out, is it right? You know, just because it's out there, it may not be the right thing. I think, you know, the old saying about if all, you know, all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. not to take this new shiny hammer that you found and try and hit all the, everything that you with it. It looks like it might be a nail.
I've not heard that analogy before, but that's really good.
It's, you know, the idea that you can, you know, you should vet it. You know, is there a business use case, you know, for the business you're in? I mean, sure, if you want to go off and do a side project, a hackathon type thing to learn it and appreciate it and, you know, understand it, that's totally a, I think, a valid use of time. That's one of these things that we have to do in the technology space is make time for those things. But at the end of the day, you have to be ready to say no and say, this isn't the right, maybe it'll be ready in a couple of years. You know, this first revision of this new technology isn't what we need, but we'll come back to it. And, you know, it's not a do or die on the first time you look at it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, if you could think back to when you started out in your career, I mean, when did you say did you start out in your career? Was it 1990?
2003.
Oh, 2003. So if you could cast your mind back to 2003 and look at David Luanda back then, is there anything you'd wish you were told back then that you've had to go on and learn the hard way?
I think there's definitely, I mean, besides the technical, you know, staying up on things, being ready to pivot, being ready to, you know, absorb change. Yeah, I think a lot of it is the soft skills of working in a team, you know, understanding how software is never done. I mean, my first job was tough because that was a hard bridge because at that point we were building software that was going to be burned into ROMs that were shipped into satellites that were going into space that really couldn't be changed. You basically had to get it right the first time. But since then, you know, working, whether it's anything consumer facing, you know, where there's always another app update, there's always a, you know, another rev of the software that's going to come around, whether it's new feature or bug fix or so. Figuring out how to pace yourself. I mean, obviously a lot of stuff in that time since I started, you know, the agile methodologies have really come to become a popular way of building software, which I believe in a lot of those things. But one of the things that comes out of the agile, it's just the terminology of a sprint. The idea that you're expected to, you know, this is a sprint. I think Scrum is great because it does feel kind of like a rugby scrum where you're, you know, you're all heads down, pushing the pile, doing that sort of thing. But the term sprint really rubs me the wrong way because it's a marathon. And as we, no, you can't sprint a marathon where you're just going to burn out. And so figuring out how to be agile and with a little a, not necessarily big A agile, but little a agile to iterate and improve and know when to, you know, cut off the development for this phase and say, you know, we're just going to push this to the next go round. Be willing to accept that it's not always going to be perfect. The old, you know, the one saying we've been saying a lot recently is don't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Yeah.
You know, or don't let perfect be the enemy of done. You know, get it out there, ship it. Obviously, there's some cost to shipping things, your maintenance and that sort of thing. But in the end of the day, the code that you ship is, you know, what you have to hang your hat on. So, you know, get it out there, figure it out. You know, minimum viable product is a risky thing for sure, because it quickly evolves and mutates beyond what that is. I think a lot of it is also knowing what code not to write. I mean, the best code you're ever going to write is the one you don't, because there's no bugs in code that you didn't write.
Yeah.
So yeah. Knowing where to step away and say, yo, this is, you know, trying to over-engineer things. Another term that doesn't rub me the right way is clever. If you're coming up with a clever solution, you're probably doing it wrong. Because, you know, whether it's you or somebody else is going to have to maintain that clever, and maybe they're not as clever as you are. You know, and that shouldn't be a penalty on them. That's a penalty on you for not being, you know, the clever solution is making it obvious and clear. I mean, the other big thing is just maintainability. You know, has got to be the number one driver of any longstanding code base. Sure, if you're building a side project, a prototype, and you're going to, you know, just whip it together, you know, like a homework assignment in college, that's one thing. But if you're building code that's going to, and which you should always assume it is, because every good prototype ends up shipping for the most part, that, you know, whether it's yourself or anybody else is going to have to figure out what's not working right at 2 a.m, 6 months, a year, 3 years from now. You better be ready for that.
That is amazing advice. That is amazing advice. Yeah. You kind of blew me away a bit there. There's a lot to take in, but it's incredible. I think for one final question, maybe if I could ask, what advice would you give to mobile engineers who are looking to get into streaming? I mean, we touched upon it a little bit before, but what would the advice be?
Yeah, I think, again, it's just, you know, good fundamentals.
Yeah.
You know, just, you know, good fundamentals of mobile engineering. I think a lot of streaming is one of the spots, you know, where there is a longstanding path, I think, for mobile apps. I think, you know, the initial spike and splash of mobile and, you know, having an app for everything definitely feels like it's waned in the past few years after, you know, from 2008 to 2010 to 2016, even, you know, everything was just trying to go mobile, you know, again, hammer and nail analogy might apply. But since then, I mean, one thing that, you know, you're just never going to get away from is quality streaming as in a native app. So I think having a lot of just strong fundamentals. I mean, streaming is hard because you're pushing a lot of data, you know, right now, whether it's 720p or 1080p data, soon will be 4K. You know, that's a lot of data over. I mean, now obviously we've started to roll out 5G here in the States, and I know that's going worldwide. You know, offload some of that, but having lived and worked through the 3G and 4G generations, you know, being aware of, you know, networking can be tough. You know, especially wireless networking, cellular networking, being ready to, you know, and battery life, making sure you're not just, you know, obviously these bigger phones have much better batteries than they did 3, 4, 7, 8 years ago, but still, you know, being respectful of the user's, you know, data usage and battery usage in a way to deliver the performance where you're not, you know, pegging a processor, or sucking up all the RAM when, you know, when building your app is important because, you know, streaming, it's, you know, if the app crashes in the middle of the stream, people are going to, you know, the users are going to be really annoyed. If the app crashes, you know, on a more, you know, of a less long-term use app, I'm trying to think, you know, even a banking app where, you know, you're checking your balance or whatever, and the app crashes. All right, you go, you relaunch the app, and you get back in, and you can get, you know, if it's a more stateless app, but streaming is much more stateful in that it, you're expecting it just to continue playing for whether it's a 30-second highlight clip from the game last night or the 3-hour game. You know, you just want, you know, if you're, you know, you're a fan of whatever sport, you know, you're watching that game, you expect, you know, you want to be able to enjoy it, and if, you know, if it times out at the, you know, when the winning home run is hit, that's going to be bad news for the, you know, for your user. So it's, again, it's just, it's fundamentals. It's just that, you know, and that's where I think the embedded systems background that I brought to mobile, since I got into mobile a little bit late, was important. And I think anybody should be aware of, I mean, having worked on, you know, Samsung TVs, and, you know, I've always been intrigued by the fact that there are computers in everything, whether you're building a car, you know, or you're building a microwave, or you're building a, you know, home stereo, being, you know, really aware of memory usage, CPU usage, battery usage is essential to delivering that quality experience that your users are expecting. Not just planning for the best case, but certainly planning for the worst case scenario when the network is dropping out, or the battery is running low, or making sure you don't get to the, you know, you're not the reason why the battery is running low.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And I'm just curious to find out a little, you know, do you still love baseball as much as you did now that you work so heavily in it?
I think so. It's been great having my son, who's 12, going to be 12 this year. You know, every time I, you know, question, you know, do I still have the same passion for it? I, you know, just watching him enjoy the product, found a couple bugs for us over the 4 years. You know, hey, Dad, why does it say, you know, why is the app doing this? Oh, yeah, we should fix that. You know, he's having him so invested is part of the reason, you know, maybe even if I'm not loving the game, knowing that there are so many people out there loving the game and interacting with the game is important. And I still, you know, I'll still enjoy the Yankees. I grew up a Yankees fan for the past 35 years. You know, I'll watch baseball at any sport. It's an amazing game. You know, the dynamics of it, I know it doesn't necessarily get the as much respect as it once did, you know, but I, you know, I think I'll always be a fan.
Yeah. Well, it's similar to me with cricket, although I don't work in the cricket industry, but I'm quite obsessed. I'm quite a fanatic about cricket. I don't know if you ever watch it.
Sure. I mean, you get to know how the sausage is made, you know, and that can, you know, distract from that. But then I got a work trip to the World Series in 2017,
wow.
You know, the champion, which if you're not familiar, that's the championship. Spent two games in Los Angeles, you know, very exciting in the MLB box, got to wave to or even talk to a couple of my childhood idols, former players. So, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, again, if I'm going to do something in the technology industry, why not do that?
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, I think that might wrap us up today, Dave. I mean, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It's been, you know, phenomenally interesting for me, and I've taken a lot from this, and I'm sure the people that listen to this will do too. So thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.